Hi there everyone, my name's Darcy, I'm the editor of the Stage Left podcast, and I'm just dropping in before this episode begins to let you know that we have a brand new merch line available right now. I'm currently wearing one of our black hoodie designs, which has the Stage Left podcast logo on the front, as well as on the back, but on the back it's filled with all the guests that have appeared on the Stage Left podcast. I also have one of our notebooks here, which I absolutely love. It keeps me organised with everything in the podcast. It's ring-binded and lined as well for my convenience. And I just take it everywhere I go so that I always have my notes with me. It's up to date. And it's a small, compact size as well, which helps me save space in my bag. If you want to go check it out, we also have mugs, t-shirts, stickers, more hoodie designs and tote bags as well for you. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all of our merch and help support the podcast so that we can keep producing free educational content for you all. Without further ado, let's get on with the episode.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for emerging artists going into an increasingly complex industry by sharing some of the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success. So head to the stageleftpodcast.com for episodes featuring members of Gorillaz, Radiohead, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, the 1975, Oasis, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, alongside conversations exploring the recording and live processes behind artists such as The Beatles, David Bowie, Olivia Rodrigo, Chappell Roan and Sabrina Carpenter. Today we are joined by Silke Blanjar, who stands stage left to the Grammy winning Youngblood, and we'll be taking today a leap into the decision made to go from being a drummer to a bassist, what really feels like a change when you go from a 200 capacity room venue to arena sized stages overnight, how spontaneity is engineered into shows that feel anarchic, and also what it actually takes to be tour proof at the highest level. So secret handshakes and Jaeger bombs at the ready. Thanks for joining us today, Silke. How's it going?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you. Thank you for joining us. So right now, when we're recording this, it's kind of in between like a bit of a break that you've got for the tour that you've been on, and wow, that tour has been incredible so far, and you're about to embark in a couple of months from when we're recording for a European tour and then back out to America. How do you best spend the time in between those quite intense periods of time in your life?
For me, so I just try and get, I mean, everyone says this, but try and get some rest. And I think for me as well, I try and get healthy. It's really hard to stay healthy on tour, exercise and eat well, depending on where you are in the world. I find, especially in America, it's really hard to eat well. So I try to sort of exercise and just take it easy a little bit and sort of prepare, because tour can really batter you, you know.
In what way? In what way can tour batter you?
Just, I've never known, I think, true exhaustion until doing like a 3-month tour. There's been times where I've thought I was really tired, but I had no idea, I think.
Really?
You know, okay. Because you can't really, you're on a bus every night, so you never really get a proper night's sleep. But then when you're in a hotel, you're so used to the bus that being so still in a bed means you can't sleep either. And your hours are weird. You've got late nights, early mornings. You're always on the move. Yeah, it could just be really exhausting.
So are you sleeping on a bus at the moment to get useful, or you get just back in your normal bed, I guess? Wow, that's incredible. That's so insightful. Wow, okay. And in regards to, like, obviously rest and eating well and going to the gym and getting healthy, what are kind of the habits that you miss most when you're on tour?
I'm a runner. I like running, and obviously I live in Brighton by the sea, and I can just run along the seafront. It's kind of cool here, but if we go to really hot countries, I can't. I mean, I'm Northern European. I can't handle it. I can't go running in the heat. I'll collapse. So that, I really miss that, to be honest.
So I ran the London Marathon a few years ago, and I trained running down Brighton along the seafront there. So all the way from kind of like to like kind of the end of Hove as far as you could go, all the way down to like the, you know, those kind of white cliffs area, right
there. Yeah, yeah.
Saltdean, that's where it is. And just running up and down there, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to do.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So yeah, that is something you're going to miss. It's a bit of a deep question to begin with, but if you're one day you'll probably look back on your career and you might write a book about it. I'm sure there's lots of Youngblood fans who'd be like, I'd love to read a book about your life. What would the chapter title be of this exact time in your life?
That's a really difficult question. The chapter right now, I don't know. I suppose right now he's really, the gig's really like exploded very quickly after Ozzy Osbourne died. So we're still sort of riding that wave. So I don't know, something to do with that, maybe. I don't know. But that's a really difficult question.
Well, it's interesting because so Youngblood was obviously quite close to Ozzy and sang Changes at the final show at Aston Villa, and I think that's, and then as we're recording this, it was only kind of a week or two ago that he won a Grammy for that performance. How do you find, because one thing's really interesting, if you look at your, you know, I've just last night I was doing a bit of research and looked at kind of the gigs you're playing, you jump from really small venues to like huge venues and then back to small venues as obviously a deliberate choice. That must be quite unusual for someone who's obviously played gigs in lots of different arenas and small venues. How does it feel jumping from one to the other so suddenly? Because it's quite rare. You don't really see bands do that very often.
I mean, it sort of keeps it interesting. I think everyone, Dom especially, but I mean, everyone, it really likes that it's not, you know, it's not the same every night. And I actually prefer playing the slightly smaller rooms, you know. Sort of feels more intimate and there's more connection. I think if someone's not having a good time, you can see them leave, you know, whereas if you're playing to a massive arena, it all sort of blurs into one whole, you know, so you sort of lose that and you're quite far away from them. So which sort of keeps it interesting. Yeah, you know.
And if there was one gig you've played in the last few years that if you could, you could go back and watch it from the audience's perspective, right? So you could be just sneak in the back, grab a drink and watch from the back. What gig would you choose?
I was trying to remember, sort of pick out specific gigs. They all blur into one.
Do they?
Yeah. I think at the start of last year, we did a show. We've got two new band members and the first show we did with them was at Scala. In London, which was very intimate, packed out show, and it was the first show with a bigger band. I think I would have liked to see that one.
Do you ever watch your performances back on TV or YouTube, whatever it might be?
Sometimes I watch it back on YouTube, especially if I feel like, you know, sometimes you're playing and you feel like something weird has happened or something sounded off or something felt really good or really not quite good, and I do sometimes watch them back just to see sort of what happened, because you can't always tell in the moment what's going on.
Yeah. And what have you learned watching the band back from that perspective that you might not have learned if you'd only been from the perspective of being on stage?
I mean, you hear things that, like, obviously I'm mainly listening to the drums and the bass. There's whole like guitar parts that I didn't know were in the songs that I'll hear back and I'll hear them, or you know, vocal parts that I never noticed before. And there's things about the actual performance. Like, I think, I always think that I'm moving a certain way on stage, and then you look back at it and it's never really, you know, if you think you're going really crazy on stage and you look back and you just look normal. I think that's something I learned as well. You have to really perform over the top if you want, you know, to do that.
Yeah. Really, I think there's a thing about, like, when it comes to amateur dramatics, like, you be like 200% the version of who you are.
Yes,
then,
exactly,
then you get normal, right? Then so you have to really, really over the top. So obviously, you know, for some of our, you know, listeners, they won't know this story, but it's quite a well-known story with you that you were playing the Shacklebolt Arms and you were doing some really good, by the way, I really like Candy Says, which I listened to like a couple of days, like some ethereal, nice, quite nice stuff. And I don't think it was that band, but I think it was another band you were playing. And I think someone was in the audience who knew Youngblood's manager, and you literally got an Instagram DM saying, do you want to do a world tour? Is that
something like that, basically. It wasn't a random person in the crowd. It was in a band called Public Body, and our guitarist is a producer, and his manager was there. So he introduced me to his manager. I spoke to him for a couple of minutes, and then he ended up, months later, being in an office with Youngblood's management. I'm not sure why, but... And they said they were looking for a bass player, and he said, I saw this bass player the other day, and gave them my Instagram. And then I was at the pub after work, and I got a message from one of Dom's management team. And I kind of, you know how you think, you get weird messages on the internet. So I just sort of thought, oh, who's this guy? Googled him. I was like, oh, he's got some legit artists, whatever. And then the next day he called me, yeah, and then he said, oh, it's Youngblood. It's a world tour, then a European tour and South America and America. And they did sort of make me audition. I had to send a video of me playing. But it turned out I was the only one that they were auditioning. So I'm not sure. Maybe it was just a formality. But
well, tell us about that, because a lot of our listeners are emerging artists and young musicians and young bass players, right? So what did you send them? Was it an existing performance, or did you perform something specifically for them?
They sent me three songs, and they asked me to send a video of me playing those three songs, or maybe it was four, something like that. And I remember I watched some live videos of him, because I didn't know who he was, to be honest, at the time. Watched some live videos, and I remember seeing him and his guitarist go really crazy and doing like knee slides and jumping on tables. But that's not really what I'm like. So I sent these videos in, and I really underplayed the songs, because I was like, that's not what I'm like. I don't want them to think that that's what I'm going to do. And then they got back to me, and I thought they were going to say, oh, we're looking for someone who's a bit more, you know, energetic. But they said they really liked how I underplayed it. And so that's, I think, if I had to give some advice, I would say, don't be the thing that you think they want you to be, because that might not be what they're looking for.
Be authentic, right?
I mean,
that's class. Because at the time you were mainly a drummer, but you were playing a bit of bass. How long did you pontificate over playing with a pick versus playing with your fingers when it came to playing bass for Youngblood?
I didn't really give it any thought, to be honest. I've always played with a pick on the bass just because it was easier. I played guitar first, so it was just easier. And I never really intentionally chose to go down the bass playing route. So it was just what was easiest for me. So that's what I did. And I think it suits the style most of the time as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, particularly those early records. It's very much kind of pick heavy, isn't
it? Yeah,
yeah. Because so many musicians would have been in your shoes playing gigs, and you know, your bands were doing some pretty cool stuff, but Youngblood was obviously a completely different level to where you were at. And so there'll be musicians right now who'll be listening to this on a train to go to a gig that they're going to play. Once you got that go-ahead, what was the time frame between getting the yes for the audition and then having to step on stage at an arena?
I think that maybe the message was in November or December. No, November probably. And then in January we started rehearsals. February. I remember because I got COVID right at the start of rehearsals, and I had to miss the first like 4 days, which was, I thought I was going to lose the gig, but it was fine. Okay. Yeah, we were in rehearsals for a couple of weeks and then into arena. So there was maybe 2 months.
And how did you spend that time? Was it learning his back catalogue? Was it getting your chops up on the bass? Was it deciding what equipment? So how did you spend that time so that you walked into that rehearsal pre-COVID, being in the right place to impress?
It was, they sent me the set list that it was probably going to be, and then some other songs that might be on there. So I just spent my time learning those. I was still working as well. I was working, and then in the evenings I was just learning the set over and over and over again, because I wanted to be at a point where I didn't have to think about playing the right notes, you know, because I knew I was going to be nervous. So I just wanted it to be muscle memory, really. So yeah, ran the set over and over again. In terms of equipment, they sort of were sorting all of that out for me. I didn't really have to think about that. I brought my own bass, but other than that,
Was that the Pink Mustang?
The Pink Mustang, yeah.
The famous Pink Mustang. Now, yeah. You're still playing, you don't play with that anymore, right?
I still bring it on tour, and I usually warm up with it in the dressing room, but no, I don't really use it in the set anymore.
So what are you using on stage at the moment, or what are you going to be using for this tour?
I've got a Gibson Grabber that I bought off my friend Jordan, who lives in Brighton. He plays, you might know this band, they're called The Excerpts. And I think, and he plays for Top Loader as well.
Oh, really? Oh, right.
Yeah. Awesome. But he had this bass in a lockup that he hadn't played for years. And he said he just wanted someone to play it. So he sold it to me for like £600, which is really cheap for what it is. And I love it. Yeah, that's the one I use mainly.
Hey, eBay, one day someone's going to pay a lot more than 600 quid for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very good. And I mean, how many basses do you take out on tour out of interest? Like, if something goes wrong with it, what's your backup?
I've got a backup, which is the new Epiphone Mike Dirnt grabber.
Oh, right. Nice.
Which is really nice. And then I've got a couple of basses that I play in different tuning. So I think we have about five. I have about five that I bring. So I've got one in E standard, one in E flat, and one in D, and a couple of backups. Yeah.
Can you think of anything that's like ever happened where it could have actually curtailed the show other than illness? Like, is there anything that is a bit like close to the line that actually, if we weren't a bit more lucky, the whole show would have been cancelled?
There's a few times where we've done the show and then we come off stage and one of the crew will be like, oh, we nearly didn't have a show today. But they don't tell the band about it until afterwards, obviously, because they don't want to stress anyone out. But I guess it's because equipment not working properly or not turning up on time if there's like a big logistics error. I remember once we were on a tour a couple of years ago and someone in the middle of the tour realized that there was one show that we weren't going to be able to make it. It was too far away. And basically there'd been this big mistake in the route planning of the tour, and a very last minute tour managers had to scramble together some sort of gear rental situation and flying the crew back and forth and stuff like that. So that was pretty close, I suppose.
Wow. There's so much riding when you're playing to these venues, like, you know, the ones you're about to go to, like 18,000 cap and that type of thing. There's so much riding on it to, you know, it's not just the few people on the stage, is it? So when you, let's go back to those early rehearsals. I think as much as of being in a band and working within a band and working with an artist is kind of relationships with other people. What do you remember about kind of getting to know the existing members of the band and the crew of those, you know, how did you settle into that so quickly?
I mean, I think that was a big part of being hired. They after I sent the videos of me playing, I had to meet the guitarist Adam and the guitar tech Ben at the time for a pint in London, basically to see what I was like. And I think at the end, I basically told them I didn't really play the bass very often, and I didn't know who Youngblood was, and I'd never done a tour like this. So I thought they were going to be like, well, maybe not. But they said, because I was sort of laid back and chill and we got along, then that's why they wanted me on tour, because ultimately most of the day is not playing the show. Most of the day is hanging out. So, I think I really got along with everyone quite quickly. Everyone's so nice on this gig, which I found out later is not normal. A lot of the crews say that, you know, even they've been offered other work that's maybe better paid or whatever, but they will choose to do this gig because everyone's so nice, because the environment's nice.
Awesome. And how do you deal with like last minute change? Are there any kind of last minute changes in set list or keys or anything like that you have to deal with, or is it pretty?
Oh yeah, all the time. Dom's very spontaneous, I suppose. I mean, he has ADHD as well, which means his mind's just 1,000 miles a minute. So there's quite a lot, but I mean, I'm sort of used to it now, really.
How do you get out of a hole if you're kind of in a situation where, you know, so I won't name them, but I know of like household legends, right, who've been invited on stage to jam in that moment and they didn't know the key or whatever, and they've literally just turned the guitar down. Like,
really?
Yeah. So have you got any like secrets for musicians just to get out of a hole if like Dom says, right, we're going to do it in this key or in this particular way, and you're like, oh, I'm actually not 100% sure how to go about it?
I've had that before, actually. Now that I think about it, we had to do we were on a European tour, and then he had like a rescheduled intimate show, like an acoustic show from before I joined, that we had to quickly go and do, and it was going to be no tracks, no click, just, you know, just vibes. And on the way there, I was like, so all the songs are the same key, same everything. And they were like, yeah, it's fine. And then we get to sound check and we start playing the songs, and it turns out half of them are in different keys. So I'll be honest, I was really stressed and everyone was making fun of me because I was so stressed. But I think ultimately you have to just tell yourself that you know what you're doing, you know. I mean, I was running the songs in the dressing room, sorry, but you just got to reassure yourself that you're there for a reason and you know what you're doing. And also ultimately, if you do panic, I suppose you can always turn your guitar off, although I wouldn't recommend it, I don't think.
No, that's not.
Yeah.
But I think just to reassure musicians out there that probably having a process or way to get through that and plan for that is probably a useful thing to do. And we interviewed, I don't know if you know, Gail Ann Dorsey, who's David Bowie's bassist, like an amazing bass player, an incredible singer, like an absolute elite musician. And she said that once David's voice was not quite, and he said, okay, so we're going to go down like a semitone. And she said like the whole world fell out in that moment, in that situation, even though that she was at this kind of elite level. And she was like, okay, that's a bit of a difficult thing. So maybe having a backup or knowing how to get out of that situation or prepping for it is probably going to help.
Yeah, we do have that with Dom's voice as well. We sometimes drop songs down, but for me the parts aren't really complicated enough for me to really stress about that. Do you know what I mean?
What's the so as it, given your heart is as a drummer, I'd imagine, because that was your kind of first instrument, was there any particular drummers that you know who we've all been to gigs, right, as a young person gone, right, that's what I want to do. Okay, was there a particular gig you went to and went, right, I want to be a drummer?
I wanted to be a drummer when I was like four, really, so I don't really remember. My dad was a percussionist and like a Latin American percussionist, and he had these congas in our house, in our attic, and he used to play with me, and I think that's why I wanted to do it. So I started out playing percussion, like Latin American percussion. I played in a lot of samba bands, stuff like that. But then when I sort of got, like, became like 12 or 13, I thought I want to be in a rock band because it was cooler. But I think for me, the thing that always, the gigs that inspired me to become a musician was never really any big shows of big bands. It was more local shows, local musicians. It always felt a bit more tangible, a bit more achievable, you know. So most of my biggest inspirations when I was playing in bands and learning to play the bass when I was sort of a teenager in my early 20s was the local music scene, really, to be honest. I remember my percussion teacher when I was a kid was a big inspiration, just because she was like a woman making a living out of music. I didn't necessarily want to be a famous rock star, I just wanted to make a living out of it, you know. So seeing people, real people that I knew that I could speak to doing that, that was more inspiring.
What's her name?
She's got a Dutch name, Titia Val.
And does she know that? Does she know what you're doing now and that you credit her?
I think my mum emailed her recently. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's great. And, you know, you said about playing samba. I mean, what an education, like rhythm-wise, to get. You know, even though you said it wasn't as cool as being in a rock band when you were 12 or 13, but like I'd imagine that gets you out of a lot of holes and different time signatures and stuff like that. That was probably a great education for you.
Hi everyone, it's Darcy again. I'm just interrupting the episode briefly to let you know that our merch line is available right now. We have hoodies, mugs, notebooks, tote bags, stickers, t-shirts, anything you can imagine online right now to help you support the podcast. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to go grab yourself some lovely Stage Left merch and help us support the podcast so that we can keep producing free and educational content for you all. I won't keep you too long, so let's get back to the episode.
Yeah.
We have a lot of listeners who are emerging musicians who have to navigate this world of, I want to pursue this career. Like I'm in my early 20s, for instance, I want to pursue this career. But my parents are like, need to get a proper job. And I'm putting that in inverted commas.
Yeah.
How were your parents with that? And what is the way in which you navigated that? Because you said about just making a living out of the industry, which I think is very feasible. It's a different thing wanting to be a rock star, right? Because that's like zero. You're in the 0.001% doing that right now, which is amazing. But how were your parents around the idea of you going into the music industry?
They were actually really supportive. I had they never really told me that I shouldn't do it. My mum always said to me, someone's got to do it. It's a real job. People do it, so why shouldn't you do it? That's what she said. And I had a lot of teachers, because I was quite good at school. I had a lot of teachers at school be like, you're throwing your life away. You know, you've got this opportunity. You should study a real subject, quote unquote. And you know, what are you doing going into music? You'll never make it, sort of thing. But my parents always had my back, actually, which is rare, I think.
It's really rare.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And do they, you know, are they, if they come and see your shows, is there something that's in your mind when the prospects of playing with your parents there?
They come to shows that with Youngblood, they'll come to like maybe one or two a year. But before that, when I was in smaller bands, my dad would always be there, to be honest. Yeah. He became a bit of a local legend in the scene, in the music scene in Oxford, where I grew up, because he was at all the shows. Yeah. But it makes me really nervous when they're there, to be honest. Now, it's much more nerve-wracking playing to two people that you care about than to 10,000 people that you don't know.
That just blows my mind. I've heard that before. That's so interesting that you could be. Someone once said to me, they're playing Wembley Stadium, right? Mm. And there's whatever there is, like 78,000 people in there, and they were just not nervous. They played two nights, and they're just not nervous. First, second night, they were a bag of nerves just because two people in there, and it was mum and dad.
Yeah.
What do you think's going on there? What do you think's going on in your head there? If you to analyse that,
I don't know. I remember my first show with Youngblood was at Cardiff Arena, and I knew my dad was coming, and my dad and my sister were coming, and I thought I'll be all right. I won't be able to see them. There's 8,000 people there, and then I walked out on stage, and they were right at my eye level, right in front of me, just like looking straight at them. So I saw them immediately. I don't know why it makes me nervous. Just I guess when it's someone who you respect, and you want them to respect you, and you don't want to mess up, I suppose. Whereas if it's someone you don't know, maybe you care less about what they think. Not sure.
Really interesting. What else, if you were to look back at the theme of gigs, if you were to pull out the gigs that you felt most relaxed on stage, what are the things, if you could pick out all the things that make you feel relaxed before going on stage, what would they be? Is it like a really detailed sound check? Is it having the right balance in your ears? Like, or is it what you're doing in the hours beforehand? So for you, if you were to paint your utopia of your most comfortable on stage... What is that?
For me, it would be being well rehearsed, first of all, as a band. And if the sound check goes really well, it does make me relaxed. Then also for me, a big thing is the hours between sound check and the show. It feels like 3 days. It's the longest time you'll ever have to wait. And I think if I have something to do during that time, it makes it go a bit faster, have a much better show, because otherwise I'm just sat in the dressing room with my thoughts waiting to play the show, and you get really sort of anxious and antsy and you want to just go out there. So being rehearsed, having a good sound check, and then filling that time with something other than just thinking about the show, so that it's a bit more sort of spontaneous when you walk out there, you know.
I honestly think that gap is the root cause for why you have the kind of debauchery of alcohol and drugs in the music industry. You've just done the sound check and you're now going to be playing this big show and you've got all this energy. You're kind of ready to go, but then you've got to kill 3 hours. And yeah, you want to go and see the sport band, but if you're on a tour, you might have seen them two or three times already. Oh, I might as well open a beer or, you know, whatever it might be. So what works for you to best be in a position to go on stage?
That was one of the hardest things for me going into touring at this level. And I really struggled for a while to find stuff. I got really into online chess for a while. and then I did get into drinking for a while, you know, just every day.
Yeah.
I tried to read a lot on tour. I tried to, because I didn't read much when I was younger. So I was catching up on all the classics. Did that for a while. I don't know, I find little things that you can do. Like I draw sometimes. Yeah.
It's hard. How does it feel if you have friends and family and guest lists there? Because I know, like, there's always a bit of a panic as the guest. I mean, for people who aren't ever been in this situation, guest lists are so inconsistent. Like, you could be like your best friend, Silky's best friend, could be on the guest list. They'll turn up and go, oh, actually, no, the name's not on there. And so, which I know can cause a lot of stress for people who are about to walk on stage. And I know of situations where people have played in America, like in Madison Square Garden, their parents have flown over from the UK and they turn up 10 minutes before. They weren't on the guest list for some admin reason, and the phone's in the locker and they're going on stage and they miss a show. So you have all this kind of stuff going on. Do you have to deal with that? And is that something that kind of takes your mind up, or is it okay?
It's so stressful having people on the guest list. I can't relax until I know that they're in the venue.
Right.
So if I do have people come in, I try to urge them to come earlier rather than later so that I can make sure that they're in. I mean, obviously we have tour managers and whoever who are great and will make sure everyone gets in who needs to get in, but there's always little things that can go wrong. So I can't relax at all until whoever I've invited is in the venue.
Can you explain to us why that is, right? Because that's my head. It's like I just don't understand how consistent that is. That there's someone who's missing off there. That they've is someone just not keeping an Excel spreadsheet?
I've no idea. Or something like that. It must be. I don't know. Yeah,
because it causes the band so much stress, right? Yeah. Just before you go on, you don't need that, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah, and everyone's always, even though you've put someone on the guest list, everyone will always check two or three times that this person is actually on the guest list, because I don't know why it happens. I mean, people have, tour managers have a lot to think about, so maybe things just get missed. I don't know.
What do you think, as a musician who has played gigs at different levels and your career has kind of really accentuated quickly, what do you think is different about what you imagined this job to be? So if we'd gone back a number of years and said, you know, you're going to be playing arena level shows, you can play in the Howard Stern show, you're going to be playing, you know, these huge American TV hit shows and that type of thing. What's different?
What's different? It's a lot more waiting around than I thought. There's right. This famous phrase, hurry up and wait, which is basically what your life becomes, is you sort of get rushed into a venue to then wait.
Wow.
And then you get rushed on stage, and then you're on stage and you have to wait, and then you sound check, and then you get rushed off, and then you have to wait. You're always rushing to get somewhere, and then you have to wait around. You know, it's a lot more, and that's what I found the hardest, is just all the waiting around. You spend a lot of time at the airport, in hotel lobbies, in dressing rooms. You know, you travel the world, but you don't really get to see very much unless you have a day off on the off chance. But it's not as glamorous as maybe people imagine, I think. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I'm trying to think if you do some running in the meantime, but I guess you can't go running between the sound check and the gig, right? You can't go for
I do sometimes, but I go running between the sound check and the gig, yeah. Maybe not a 10K, maybe a 5.
Okay. But there needs to be someone needs to invent something for that 3-hour gap. So, you know, maybe online chess is the way.
I don't like staring at a screen all day, but yeah, sometimes you don't have a choice.
Right.
Okay. Really.
What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to fast forward a load of decades, and you're lying in a hammock, right? And
great.
You've got like a beer or not a cocktail or non-alcoholic beverage, and you're looking back on your kind of professional career, right? And now you're kind of done. You're like, you're in your 70s, and maybe you still do a little bit here and there, but kind of the idea of going on big tours and that kind of, you know, 40-hour working week for the rest of us, but probably more hours for you, is kind of over and done. What do you want to achieve, accomplish, or complete that you haven't quite got around to yet?
I think I'd like to get more into the sort of songwriting and production side of stuff. I grew up making music with my little brother, and he's a really amazing songwriter, and we used to make music together, but now obviously I'm never here and we just don't really do that anymore. And I think I'd love to make an album with him together. And then maybe, you know, work with other artists in that respect, songwriting and production, yeah.
What stopped you so far?
Honestly, I always thought, I've only recently realised that I can do it. Do you know what I mean? I've always had this thing, this voice in my head saying that, you know, whatever I thought was good, it probably wasn't good enough, or I didn't really have anything to say. But now I realise that if I think something sounds good, then that's good enough. You know, turns out other people also think it sounds good. And I just didn't really have the confidence in my own opinions, I think.
It's really interesting that, because I don't know if you know the idea of kind of external versus internal validation. And basically, like most musicians, when they start out, they seek external validation, which is like, I need other people to tell me this is good for me to really believe that it is good.
Yeah.
And it's like what I do, like coaching on a one-to-one basis with people. And like often we talk about how can we identify like what good is for ourselves and fuck everybody else's opinion. Like if we think it's good, like that's it. And it's like a really interesting, difficult journey. If you were producing and songwriting, what's your go-to instrument to write?
Guitar, really.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, guitar. Sometimes I like piano because I don't really know how to play it, so it sort of makes you creative in a different way. But I like to have I'll record like a drum loop. I guess the rhythm is maybe the starting point for me. So I'll record a drum loop and then work off there. I can't really just write on a guitar on its own. I need to have a beat so I can sort of feel the groove of the song. Yeah.
Nice. And so what you need to have is a deadline, because if you're perfectionist and you're worried about what other people potentially think, like, yeah, it'll just be like, you'll just end up with like version 83.333, you know, that never
gets released.
That's
exactly what I do, yeah.
Same. And there's big bands, I've known, like bands like Lightning Seeds, Elbow, have been exactly the same with Rare Records. And one of the ways to do that is just to delegate the decision to like a producer, to say, or someone else, to go, this is done, like, now move on. Like, there's this kind of whole theory of perfectionism that once you're 80% happy with it, you should just move on, like, and just go on to the next thing, because that remaining 20%, you'll just go round in circles trying to perfect it. So sure. you should do something with your brother at some point, because I think that would be really fulfilling that you could do. What kind of style would it be in? Do you know what
yeah,
would it be
he
like?
I mean, I guess he makes, like, I suppose it's like indie pop, but that doesn't really do it justice. I think he's a poet, a very good lyricist, and he's a classically trained pianist, so he has all these interesting sort of harmonies and melodies, and yeah, he's really great.
Right, great.
I'm not here to plug him necessarily, but he is really great.
He's really great. Oh, yeah. Fantastic. So when it came to, you talked about your education on being in the samba band and you know, the drums, did you get a lot of formal, you know, your brother's classically trained, did you get a lot of formal education, and what are you taking out of that, if so, in your practice today still?
I think because my parents were so supportive of me doing music for a living, because ever since I was a kid, I never changed my mind. That's what I wanted to do. They were very happy to take me to lessons and stuff like that. So I was born in Amsterdam, and I lived there until I was seven.
Yeah. So I had. And you won an award, right, when you were six?
I did, music, yeah. Right? How did you know that? Yeah, I did.
You got to do your research, right?
Yeah. I was in a samba band in Amsterdam called Los Niños del Ritmo. And yeah, thank you. I was maybe six, so I don't know how much of a band you could call it. The other kids were a bit older, maybe 10 to 13. But yeah, we won an award in like a music competition. Yeah, and then we moved to the UK, and I was in a samba band with my dad there, which wasn't like a formal thing. It was just like a community samba band, I suppose. And I was the only child in a band full of adults.
Wow.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that experience?
I mean, I suppose stuff about playing live, playing together with other people. We used to play a lot of carnivals and stuff like that. I didn't really speak English at first when I moved, so I didn't really know what was going on. I was just, you know, playing the shaker or the tambourine or stuff like that. Yeah, I did have lessons on drums, and then lessons on the guitar from my friend's dad. And I had piano lessons for a couple of years, but then I cut the top of my finger off, and I had to stop. They reattached it, but
So does that impact your bass playing? Because it's on your left hand, right?
Yeah, I don't really have much feeling in it, which is actually probably a good thing.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah. Right? Wow. So I've had a lot of lessons in various things, not the bass, but other instruments, which.
And did you want to go to those lessons? Because I've got, you know, we were talking about before we began, I've got two kids, two girls, and I want them to get into music, and they're getting into music. And I kind of think now, if I'm like saying, come, let's go to piano lessons, I can't see they're going to want to do that, right? So did you always want to go to those lessons, or sometimes did it feel like a chore?
Sometimes I didn't want to go, yeah. But I knew, most of my parents were like, well, if you're not going to go now, then you're never going to go again. You're either doing it or you're not doing it. So I went every week, and obviously you have to just keep going, because I knew that's what I wanted to do for a living. It's what I like doing. Sometimes parts of it won't be very enjoyable. Parts of it will be boring, practicing rudiments or scales or anything like that, but you just have to do it. You have to look at the bigger picture, I suppose, which is hard when you're a kid, I know. But
yeah.
Yeah.
And so the question I asked about, like, what did you learn from that experience with the band of, you know, older people? What's something a young musician might learn from working with, you know, Dom's Youngblood that they might not learn working with anyone else?
Something you'd learn from Youngblood that you wouldn't learn from anyone else? I don't know. I think what he's really great for in terms of being in his band is that he lets everyone add their own, put their own spin on the songs. So in that sense, it's really helped grow my confidence, just try out ideas and stuff like that. So I would say...
Because you don't play in the studio, right? So you take what's all done in the studio and you're allowed to create something slightly different.
Yeah, so I just do the live show and he sort of encourages, I mean, obviously within reason, but he encourages you to put your own spin on things. And I don't think all artists are like that, especially at that level. So you sort of learn to trust in your own tastes and try stuff in the moment. He's very happy for you to just try stuff during the show as well that you've never done before, you know, so to be adventurous, I guess, and spontaneous.
What challenges do you think exist for musicians now that didn't exist when you started going into music?
Well, the big thing, I guess, is social media, which is a challenge and a tool, I suppose, and an opportunity. But, having to market yourself on the internet is a whole new thing, which I've never been very good at. I don't really have any interest in doing, but I know that I need to. So that's the big one, I would say.
What is it about posting on social media that feels, you know, different? Is it something that it doesn't feel very natural to you, or is it unsure what you should post, what you couldn't post?
It just doesn't feel very natural to me to sort of have to sell myself or something, you know. It sort of feels like you're sort of showing off, maybe. I don't know. It's something about it. It doesn't really suit my personality, I think. I don't really like having my picture taken or the sound of my own voice, you know. So this doesn't really come very naturally to me to, like, put myself out on the internet for everyone to see.
I wanted to move on to, like, advice that's been given to you. So you're kind of passing on loads of advice to our listeners now, which is obviously amazing. Thank you, Silke, for that. What's the best advice someone's given you?
One of our crew said to me, because obviously everyone deals with imposter syndrome, but I was at the time. I was like, what am I doing here? I'm not even very good. And he said, someone once told him that you can learn everything else, but you can't learn how to be a nice person. So he said, if you're easy to get along with and you're good to hang out with on tour, you can learn everything else. You can become a better musician, a better roadie, a better engineer, better whatever, but you can't really change your personality. So that's what I think about all the time, really.
Wow.
When I feel like I don't belong there or whatever, you know.
I think that's great advice for emerging musicians, particularly people who are like stage left, bassist, drummers, that type of thing. We had a guy on, the drummer from Chic, Ralph Roll, and he said that the industry is very small and you can easily get not a great reputation.
Yeah.
And he said the aim of musician is to not get the word "but" after their name. So they're like, oh, this person's great, but they've got their heroin problem, or they're great, they're great, but they're always late, or, you know, that.
Oh, yeah.
You want to avoid having the "but" next to your name. Okay, that's really good advice. If you had, if it was 25 hours in a day, what would you do with your extra hour?
Oof. Good question.
And you're not allowed to say sleep.
No, I wouldn't say sleep. I wouldn't say sleep. No. Probably spend it outside, just sitting outside. No screens, no headphones, nothing. Just cold turkey outside in nature, preferably. Yeah.
So you're born in Amsterdam and then you moved to Oxford. Was nature part of something, you know, you yearning for that? Was that part of your upbringing or not really?
We moved to a little village near Oxford. So very much in the countryside. Yeah. Very green. Very nice.
Yeah. And tell us about the scene there. So what specifically was the scene there? Was it lots of kind of just emerging bands having battle of the bands type things, or?
It was more I mean, at the time, I think I really lucked out with the timing. There was a real sort of golden age, I think, for the Oxford music scene. And it was just this really welcoming and supportive community. It wasn't necessarily people who wanted to be famous or make money out of music. It was just people making music because they enjoyed it. And it was just so, so welcoming and such just like a warm community. And it sort of provided this platform to be able to, I played in like 5 or 6 different bands at the time, sometimes at the same time. And just to try stuff and like try writing music and try different instruments, try being a bassist, because why not? Because you know that they'll be nice, you know, and it wasn't competitive or anything like that. It was just like, just a support network, I suppose.
If there was one band from back then that you think deserved to make it but never did, what were they called?
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah.
There was a really cool grunge band that I liked. They're not together anymore. They're called Slate Hearts. And then there was a band called Lucy Leave, who made this really sort of kind of weird, like artsy music, a bit like Deerhoof, sort of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were so many. There was a, I was in an emo band. There was a couple of emo bands that were really good. Yeah, I don't know, but it never really seemed to be on anyone's mind to like break the industry, really.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's interesting. So it wasn't like you pursued it as a career through that. That was just a bit of fun that people were having.
Yeah, I mean, it's where I learned how to do everything that I do now for my job. It's where I learned how to be in a band and play shows. But it was never with the intention of being famous or anything like that.
And you don't have to share this if you don't want to, but it's an interesting thing for emerging musicians now in regards to like how they support themselves financially. Did you have other jobs that you were doing at the same time? And what were some of those jobs to keep ticking over?
Yeah, I always had a job, always worked. So straight out of school, I got a job. It's this guy in Oxford who has like 50 to 60 wooden boats. And I worked for him for like a year full time before I went to uni, fixing the boats, basically. So like woodworking. Did that for 3.5 years, I guess, full-time and part-time when I was at uni, part-time. And after that, I worked at Tesco. I worked nights at Tesco during COVID. I worked at a couple of different guitar shops, one in Oxford, one in Brighton. I worked at B&Q. I've got the hat on right now.
Yeah, yeah, right, wow.
And then when I got the job for Youngblood, I was working at a place called Barefaced Audio. They make bass cabs and guitar cabs. Working there making cabs. So I've always had a full-time job on the side. Yeah.
And how does it feel now having this kind of freelance life now where it's like you're playing these large shows and then it's quiet times and then large shows again, and you know there's always uncertainty with this type of thing over a long period of time. So how does that sit with you?
It's really weird. I found it again still adjusting, but it took me a long time to adjust to. Like when you're not on tour and you just have like 3 weeks off and you don't have anything to do, you don't have to go to work. It's really a new sensation for me. I sort of went a little bit crazy, you know, not having a purpose to your day. It's an adjustment, yeah.
Yeah, I bet. And are there any other bits of advice beyond being like a good person, nice person, good at your instrument, that you think if someone was in your shoes and leapt into, you know, he was playing the Shacklebolt Arms, doing quite well, but then like leapt into this huge show. Is there any advice you'd give them around, I don't know, like management, finances, like that kind of stuff that isn't very exciting, to be honest, for many creatives, but is so important so you don't end up with like ridiculous tax bills and stuff like that?
Yeah, I keep a quite meticulous spreadsheet of my income and my outgoings. I would say keep good track of what invoices you've sent and whether they've been paid, because people aren't always very good at paying and you can miss stuff. And I would say separate your business finances from your everyday ones as quickly as possible, because it'll help you when you're doing your taxes. I have a separate card for anything work-related and anything not work-related, so it's really easy to separate the two. And just don't spend all your money as soon as you get it, because not all of it's yours. Some of it's tax. So, don't be impulsive like that. Put some aside. Put like half of it aside if you can.
Such good advice. Honestly, like there's so many young musicians won't even think about stuff like that, because understandably, and me also, when I was young, you know, you just don't think about stuff like that. But I think it's great advice. So let's pretend that, Silke, you're made president of the music industry for one day.
Yeah.
What laws are you introducing?
What laws? Paid sick leave.
Very good.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a problem for all freelancers, but if you get sick, if you injure yourself and you can't work, then you've got nothing. No money, no income, no work. So that's what I would do.
What do you think we could do to make the music industry even more inclusive for women? There's a lot that needs to be done. What do you think are kind of key things that would be kind of easy wins that need to happen?
I mean, I don't know if it's easy. It's definitely better than, I mean, I don't know, I've not been in it very long, but I feel like it's better now than it was when I was a kid. You see a lot more female musicians now, still not loads, but a lot more. I think what's still missing is a lot of women behind the scenes, you know, engineers, producers, techs. That's really rare that you see that. And I think it's probably part of still, sometimes it can be like people will hire women externally on the face of it to look like they are more exclusive. But when people are behind the scenes, you know, no one knows if that's a woman or a man. So it's usually a man. You know what I mean?
So do you think that's, what's the root cause of that? Do you think that's the opportunity in the first place to get into engineering and back, like back office stuff, and not back office, but, you know, not on stage stuff? Originally, so do you think more people need to be encouraged who are female to go to university and or to join, you know, bands and or get qualifications in like music production? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know what's I mean, probably part of the barrier is that it's sort of intimidating if you're the only woman. Like I studied production at uni, and there was, I think, three girls in my whole year doing it out of obviously hundreds of students. So it can be intimidating being the only woman in an environment, not just that's full of men, but in an industry that is, I think, historically, I mean, quite sexist, or can be quite a toxic environment. And you always, I mean, I remember at uni getting singled out because I was a girl. A lecturer would make a joke and then they'd realise it was inappropriate.
A lecturer? Sexist.
Yeah. And then they'd be like, oh, sorry, Silke, I forgot you were here, sort of thing. So it's like the environment often can be just uncomfortable and it can be intimidating. So maybe that's part of the barrier. And I think the only way to improve that really is by having more women, but also by having the men internally call out when a situation is not right. You know what I mean? Rather than just laughing and going along with it, you need the men to stand up for the women, I think.
And say that's not okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if there's no woman there, just be like, that's not okay to say that or to do that or whatever.
Great. Thank you. You've got a second day in the job as president of the music industry. What's another law you're bringing in?
Another law. I don't know. I want to say like maternity and paternity leave.
Good. Definitely.
Yeah. Because there's none of that. You know, that's also the reason why a lot of, past a certain age, you don't really see any women at all in the music industry because they have children and then they don't come back afterwards, you know.
That would be absolutely a root cause for, so even away from the music industry, if you have paternity leave and maternity leave policies, you within organisations, it closes the gender pay gap, and you're absolutely right that's going to, yeah, if you brought something in like that into the music industry, that would be transformational, and then you would see far more women over a certain age as well. Because I know people who've like chosen not to have kids because they don't know what to do with a career. You know, it's a really difficult situation.
Same.
Okay, so that's okay. Really good stuff. Thank you for sharing. Plot us out the year that you've got coming up. So how are you feeling about, so you've got European or UK shows and then you're also going to America as well. What's the rest of the year looking like?
actually going to have to look. I think with this, things change so often and so last minute that I don't mentally plan ahead more than like 3 or 4 months. I think after we come back from America, we go into festival season. So we do festivals, and then actually I don't think we have any plans yet that have been confirmed for August onwards. So I'm not sure.
We're going to wrap up there. Thank you for your time and your wisdom and your insight. It's such an incredible point in your life at the moment. You know, you're in the 0.001%. There's so many people listening to this who'd be like, what I'd give to be in that situation. So I hope you do get a chance to step back and just absorb and go, you know, you're living a lot of people's dream there. And I hope that you, I hope it really goes well in the next year or two for you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hi everyone, I hope you enjoyed the episode, but just before you go, I want to drop in again and say that our brand new merch line is available right now. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all our new hoodies, t-shirts, mugs, stickers, tote bags, notebooks to help support the podcast. If you could go over there and check that out and maybe purchase something, it's an amazing way to help support us and keep us going so that we can produce free and educational content for y'all about the music industry, which really helps a lot of young musicians and people looking to get into the industry. All of the merch is great. I love it. I have the hoodie here and I've also got one of our notebooks. And it's just a great way of helping support us and keep us going as well. So I'd be greatly appreciated if you could head over to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me and have a little look at all of our merch. It would be so, so, so appreciated. So I hope you enjoyed the episode there and go check out our brand new merch. Thank you for watching.